Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we'll get to the news of the day, but much of Washington is preparing for tomorrow, when former special counsel Robert Mueller testifies before the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees. California's Democratic Congressman Eric Swalwell, who recently ended his brief bid for the presidency, is on both committees. Congressman Swalwell, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
And I want to try a little exercise here. Georgetown law professor Neil Katyal writes today that there are just three questions to ask. President Trump said the report found no collusion, no obstruction, said it was a complete and total exoneration. The professor writes the questions are, Mr. Mueller, did your report find no collusion? Did your report find no obstruction? Did your report give the president complete and total exoneration? Do you agree?
No, but I do respect that professor very much and his service to our country. But this is not a law school exam. This is something that, you know, everyday Americans need to understand. And so we need the special counsel to lay out that Russia attacked us to help the Trump team. The Trump team welcomed it, and the president sought to cover up that attack. I think that simplifies it even more so that everyday folks can understand.
And how do you expect to do that? I mean, how pointed will you get? We know that, you know, people have not read this report. So is this a chance to get some of the specifics out from the report?
Yes, but success would be if this came across like a Law and Order episode rather than a law school class. You know, we should avoid legalese and in technical terms and really just focus on the who, where, what, when, and why.
Well, how pointed will you get? Because there are questions that Americans have. For instance, the report showed that Donald Trump asked his counsel, Don McGahn, to fire Mueller, then later asked McGahn to cover up that request, to lie about it, to write a letter saying it didn't happen. People want to know, why isn't that obstruction? Are you saying you'd rather not ask Mueller the question, why isn't that obstruction? You'd rather have him lay out what was in the report?
It's best that Mueller lays out just the facts. And he is Act One. He won't be the final witness. In fact, he will direct us to other witnesses, but he can certainly tell us and set the table as to what happened.
As you well know, Americans are not sure they want to hear it. An April poll from Hill Harris showed 72% of Americans don't think anything else about the Mueller report can affect their thinking either way. And Mueller himself has said, this report is my testimony. Do Democrats run the danger of maybe a hostile witness who doesn't want to say more than he's already said in the report?
We should certainly avoid having that type of encounter. And again, just stick to what he has written. That is certainly enough. Just tell us what the Russians did, how the Trump team benefited from it, and what the president did to cover it up. And then from there, we have all the eyewitnesses that we can subpoena. You know, many of them the president is telling to not testify, and so we'll have to go through court fights to get them in. But most Americans, you know, have not read the Mueller report, and seeing is believing. And so I believe, you know, having the special counsel raise his right hand and lay out this vast report, but, you know, again, to just keep it simple, that's the best approach.
Well, as you know, your Republican colleagues have said they view tomorrow's testimony as a way to seal President Trump's reelection, because ranking members of both the Judiciary and Intelligence Committees say the Mueller investigation is over and done with. That's the tone they're going to bring in. That's what they think the American public will hear. Do you run that danger of once again coming out at the other end with Mueller saying, I didn't have enough to clear him, but I didn't have enough to charge with obstruction?
Well, no American wants to see us go through the mess that we saw in 2016. So even if a prior Congress could not imagine that this would happen with the campaign and never wrote laws to prevent it from happening, I don't think that means that future elections, the American people would like to see campaigns draw themselves really close to foreign adversaries, seek and receive their help, and then cover up investigations. But something that I think we also have to focus on is that this is not just about the past. Nowhere in the Mueller report does he say that these contacts with the Russians have ended and that we are safer today than we were when the Russians did this. And, you know, we have a big presidential election coming up not too long from now. And, you know, the American people want to be assured that their vote will matter and that a foreign adversary will not have its say in an upcoming election.
What's the biggest mistake you think Democrats can make? You've said if they make it more, you know, law school, but be more specific.
You know, I believe if we're talking more than Mueller, you know, that would be a mistake. You know, he sticks within the four corners of what he's testifying about. So sometimes you may have to lead him. But, you know, really, we don't want to be in a position where we're constantly challenging him because, again, he's already going to be treated in a hostile fashion by the Republicans.
Well, Congressman, are you saying something else that maybe the Democrats shouldn't grandstand? That this isn't about really?
Yes, this is Congress, so that there's always that risk. But we know what we need to achieve, and it's to make the most significant person in the room the person who conducted the investigation and met with the witnesses and reviewed the evidence.
That's Congressman Eric Swalwell, the Democrat from California, a member of both the House Intelligence and Judiciary Committees that will begin day-long hearings with former Special Counsel Robert Mueller tomorrow. Congressman Swalwell, thanks very much.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.
Well, the next Prime Minister of Great Britain, Boris Johnson, takes office tomorrow. The former mayor of London scored an overwhelming victory over Jeremy Hunt in the Conservative Party leadership race, and Johnson spoke after the results were announced today.
We are going to energize the country. We're going to get Brexit done on October the 31st. We're going to take advantage of all the opportunities that it will bring in a new spirit of can-do.
Let's get reaction now from Europe. Bernd Riegert is European correspondent for Deutsche Welle. He's in Brussels. Bernd, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
Doing fine. So tell us about the reaction in Europe, in mainland Europe, to Johnson's election.
Well, the reactions officially, of course, courtesy. Every politician is congratulating him, promising to work constructively with him, whatever that means. But if you talk to politicians or MEPs here in Brussels privately, they are very skeptical if Boris Johnson can actually deliver Brexit and is he possibly in the shape to step back from the red lines the British government had so far. And if he doesn't do that, then the withdrawal agreement cannot be renegotiated. This is a very clear position here in Brussels. So the only thing they can offer is to maybe rewrite the political declaration that comes with the withdrawal agreement. But the agreement itself, 500 pages, cannot be touched.
So you don't think that there's any chance that Europe will make a new deal with Boris Johnson?
Well, that depends what Boris Johnson has to offer. If he just says, I want Brexit on my terms, then nothing will happen on the EU side. If he is more flexible and if he possibly steps back from his red lines and says we can stay in the internal market or we can stay in a customs union or we can make sure that there is no hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, then maybe the EU is able to also to be more flexible. But as it stands now, there is no plan on the table. Nobody knows here in Brussels exactly what does Boris Johnson want. Is he just a clown or is he really a serious politician who has a plan?
So we've heard a lot about the fears in the UK of a no-deal Brexit if Britain just crashes out of the European Union on the 31st of October, you know, lack of supplies and a run on money and all those kinds of things. What about in mainland Europe? What are the concerns if Johnson actually carries through on what he's been talking about, which is a no-deal Brexit?
Well, a no-deal Brexit would also be a catastrophe or disaster for many sectors of the economy in mainland Europe because Britain is, in some cases, the main trading partner of European countries. For example, chemicals and also car parts and cars. But if you draw a line under all of this, Britain will suffer more. This is the story here in Brussels.
We've already heard today from the French President Emmanuel Macron, who says he is going to meet with Johnson in the next few days. Who do you think that Johnson will be close with in terms of the leaders in European countries? Who will he want to be his ally?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because as a foreign minister, he used to be foreign minister till last summer, He shocked a lot of people because he was very undiplomatic. He had all his blunt rhetoric. So he has no real friends, I would say, as of now in Europe. Of course, Britain and Great Britain is important for many countries. So as a representative of Britain, he will be respected. But on a personal level, he doesn't have allies. And I think he will more turn towards the United States and try to get on good terms with Donald Trump, mm-hmm. The president there.
So, Bernd Riegert, your best guess at this point, given the news today that Boris Johnson will be the prime minister, do you think that it's more likely that the UK crashes out without a deal or that somehow something big changes and Britain doesn't leave the EU on October 31st?
Well, if Boris Johnson is not able to renegotiate the withdrawal agreement, I think he will actually postpone the Brexit date again to have more time, because in 100 days, it's not doable. I mean, it's only 3 months and 1 month is a summer break. So I don't think he will be successful and he will be flexible and not let his own country crash out of the EU with nothing.
That is Bernd Riegert, who is the European correspondent for Deutsche Welle, joining us from Brussels. Bernd, thank you.
You're welcome.
How long is your commute? Well, if you're a commuter in the metro areas of New York, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Atlanta, or Seattle, you spend at least 30 minutes on average getting to work. That's according to the latest statistics from the U.S. Census Bureau's American Community Survey. Now, even with NPR, a long commute can be stressful and time-consuming. It can add wear and tear to your car and the roads. But also, what if it's unnecessary? What if you could just work from home? Joining us now is Scott Mautz. He's a former executive at Procter & Gamble, and he writes about business. Scott, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks so much. Great to be here, Jeremy.
So how common is it right now in 2019 for people to work from home?
10 million people today work from home, which is about 6% of the workforce. And that's qualified as if you work between 2 to 3 days at home. And if you just work one day, it's even higher than that. So you're up closer to, you know, the 40 to 50 million people are now doing at least one day a week at home these days. So it's really grown in popularity. That's increased. That 10 million is up from 4 million in 2000. So it's growing in leaps and bounds. It's becoming the way of work.
But do you think that there are still a lot of people who are working from the office who could be working from home?
Oh, there is no question about that. And in fact, the number of employers now, you know, let's compare to that. The number of employers that offer the work from home option, it's increased 40% in the past 5 years, but still it's only approximately 10% of all employers offering that. So the upside for working at home is something we're just beginning to tap right now.
Well, why is that? Why are employers hesitant to allow their employees to work from home?
Yeah, my research has found really four core reasons, Jeremy. Number one, a misconception that productivity is going to be lost, and the data simply does not support that. Number two, the leaders have a little bit of the ego at stake. You know, when they don't have all the employees in front of them to lord over, it hits the ego a little bit. It makes them feel like a less perceived real leader. The third is, frankly, from the leader side, a lack of imagination. And the leaders feeling like, yeah, I get you and work from home, but this job can't be done that way. And quite often they're incorrect, unless if it's a sales job where it requires you being literally physically at the customer. Mm-hmm. There are many, many jobs that with some imagination can in fact be done just fine. And then the last thing that holds the leaders and the companies up themselves is technology. They're afraid that they're going to have to make too great of a technology investment to keep the employees connected properly with HQ. Now, there's also another side of the equation of why individuals don't ask more for the flexibility. I can get into that if you want me to, or we can leave that for
Why would an employee not want to ask for that flexibility?
Yeah, it's a two-sided coin. So we went through why leaders don't want to grant it. But we're part of this too, Jeremy. Number one, there's a real factor of FOMO. People fearing that they're missing out, having that valuable face time. We have a fear that if we're not present, our performance isn't perceived as being as high as someone else that might be in the office.
Well, is there something to that, that if you're not there around the managers, that you may not, for example, get promoted?
Companies that are more progressive are getting past that, but there's still some truth to that if the leaders perceive face time as of high value and required. So the fear that people, employees are feeling, in many cases, is very, very real, and it keeps them from not wanting to do that. They also miss the social connection. You know, people think like, boy, this option is available to me. That's great, but I really think I'm going to miss my friends. Mm-hmm. And one of the only downsides we see in the data, Jeremy, from working from home is that sense of isolation and loneliness. But there are ways around that. It's a shared issue of why we don't do more of this, both from the employee themselves and the companies.
I mean, I have to say that we have some producers who work from home, and they're incredibly prolific. And in part, that may be because they're not drawn into the daily struggles at the office, and they can just stay focused on the projects that they're working on.
And I'm not surprised to hear that, because when you stop and you look at the data available to us, in almost two-thirds of the cases, every leader that granted the work-from-home option has found productivity has increased by as much as 50%. And there are all kinds of studies now showing that, on average, if you allow an employee to work at home 4 to 5 days a week, you will get back a full day's worth of productivity, not to mention that turnover decreases, on average, by 50% when an employer is working from home. You can attract talent. Millennials, 68% of millennials, Jeremy, now say they expect a work-from-home option to be part of the package before they'll sign with a company, not to mention the reduction in stress. I'm sure your producer friends will tell you their stress goes down on the days that they're working, and they are, in fact, far more productive.
Wow. Now, you talked about FaceTime and the ability to see your colleagues. But the thing is, we spoke with a Harvard Business School professor last year about the fact that in open offices, which a lot of offices are going to these open office plans now to encourage collaboration, that in fact, the employees don't do that at all, that they may put on headphones or they communicate with colleagues who are sitting right next to them via email or instant messaging instead of talking in person.
That is 100% correct. My research has found the same thing. I call it the work-from-home shadow. They try to replicate it almost as if they were at working at home, and they try to shadow that reality. So that's exactly what happens. People try to replicate that. And what we're seeing now is the trend of open office is really starting to implode, and we're seeing more and more companies by the month. They're retracting the open office, and they're going back to either, if you're going to be in the office, people have offices, or they're really going hardcore into enabling work from home. So, yeah, that's 100% correct.
So what's the biggest plus of not allowing work from home, of having your employees in the office? What's the upside?
For sure, it's connection. And this is where most leaders will they'll glean onto this. They'll say, okay, but if my people are always there, if I don't allow that, I have the opportunity, it's easier to build a team. I have more oversight over my people to help them grow. I get more opportunities to see them live, to help them become better versions of themselves. All of that certainly makes a lot of sense, but there's not, there's things you can do to help implement and overcome that. That's why I don't suggest a work from home a regime of 5 days a week. Research is showing us the best option is for roughly 3 days to work from home, and then you allow 2 days in the office so that the leaders that enjoy the benefits of having people in the office that day are able to get that.
Okay, now I don't mean to pile on in the people should be able to work from home direction, but I will say one of the other things that I thought about on this topic is that if more people were working from home, think about how that would change the amount of traffic that exists in our cities and the amount of time that everyone wastes sitting in traffic, getting from home to the office and back home that they could be working.
That is absolutely correct. And in fact, a Commuting in America study has shown us, to your point, Jeremy, half of all people that have to commute hate it. 1 in 5 commuters say they would give an entire paycheck if they wouldn't have to commute anymore. And by the way, some of the bigger cities, it's getting to be a real problem. Your hometown city of Boston, that is the worst city out of all the top five worst cities for commutes. 56% of people that commute in Boston say they absolutely hate their commute. Number two on that list is San Francisco. 55% say they hate it. And oh, by the way, in San Francisco, over the lifetime, if you commute 3 to 4 days a week, you're talking about giving up 500 days of your life to commuting. So yes, a lot can be cleaned up if folks don't have to do that. You're helping me make the case for it.
Okay. So do you think that employers are going to recognize this new reality that you're talking about and keep up with the times and allow more employees to work from home, especially if it means better retention rates and better productivity?
I think so, because on top of productivity and retention, and we're starting to see this trend now, companies are starting to do the calculations for themselves on other things like cost savings. On average, a study has shown that we're saved almost $5 billion in just 2018 alone from allowing people to work from home part-time. That means you have less rental space for offices. You don't need as fancy as food preparation needs for people that are in the office. The cost savings is tremendous, in addition, of course, to the ability to attract and retain where people are coming from, so to get into a job. So right now we know we're in the middle of the great talent wars. And I can promise you, greater flexibility is going to be a major weapon in winning the talent wars moving forward. More and more companies are realizing that this is now the cost of doing business, Jeremy. It's not just a nice to have that sounds sexy in a company brochure. This is going to have to be a part of the way of work, getting work done moving forward.
That is Scott Mautz, who is a former executive at Procter & Gamble, who writes about business. Scott, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
And we want to hear from you. Are you allowed to work from home, and does it improve your productivity and quality of life? Let us know at hereandnow.org. And one more note on this. In Tokyo, Japan, more than 600,000 workers have been asked to work from home starting tomorrow, part of a 2-week trial plan to lighten congestion on public transit ahead of the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo. More than 20 million people use public transit there every day, and some transportation experts are worried that the subway system will not be able to handle the influx of Olympic visitors. We'll see how the trial goes.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Emberwave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. Emberwave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Emberwave, own your temperature.
And now to that budget agreement that the White House and congressional leaders reached late yesterday. The 2-year deal will raise the debt ceiling past the 2020 elections. It includes $320 billion in additional spending. President Trump announced it on Twitter late Monday. It still has to be passed by Congress, but it's a rare bipartisan agreement in this administration. NPR's congressional correspondent Susan Davis is here. And Sue, start with that additional spending. What will that be on?
The additional $320 billion in spending will set the overall target of discretionary spending for the year as close to $1.4 trillion. That extra pot of money will go to the Defense Department, to the Pentagon, on the defense side. And on the domestic side, there is expected to be more of that money to go towards veterans' health care spending, as well as more money to make sure that the 2020 census goes as planned.
Oh, yes, that 2020 census. Well, you know, the agreement includes some budget cuts. As we're hearing, not enough to offset that spending you just described.
No.
Yeah. Where will those cuts be, though?
So there's about $77 billion in what they call budget offsets. This isn't really—it's a mix of user fees, different kind of budget accounting to reduce the overall cost of the bill. But $77 billion, when you're talking about these other numbers, is really just a drop in the bucket. And one thing I think that this deal is reviving is people taking a look at the national debt. You know, the national debt is across $22 trillion. Mm. It's not coming down. If anything, it's on a trajectory to reach historic proportions. And this deal will also have the sum total effect of probably adding another $1.5 to $2 trillion to the debt of the country.
And not everyone in the Republican Party in particular is happy about that. Talk more about that.
No, I think that this is a mixed bag. I mean, there's not going to be anybody really enthusiastically casting a vote in favor of this. Republicans, of course, don't like that it doesn't do more to cut spending, but Democrats don't really like it either, except they would point out that the government is getting a lot less tax revenue coming in because of the 2017 Republican tax cuts. And that's why the country's coming up on the debt limit much sooner than originally planned, is they just don't have as much money to fulfill the country's needs. I do think everybody gets to get a little bit of what they want, more defense spending, more domestic spending, and no more default shutdown politics, at least in the short term, through the remainder of President Trump's first term in office.
Well, I was going to say, what do both parties really get out of it? And isn't that part of it? They don't have to have that fight with how those fights are viewed by voters.
Sure.
During an election season.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is intended to bring some stability to Washington, some stability to the economy, to markets who might have been nervous about the first ever national default on our debt. I also think we've had these shutdown politics in recent years, and there is a realization that there's no real winners that come out of it. So I think seeing Nancy Pelosi, Mitch McConnell, and President Trump all agree to do something tells you that they mutually agree that another round of the shutdown wars isn't really an anyone's political interest. There's many other issues that they would like 2020 elections to be waged on.
And this is a victory for President Trump.
It is. I mean, you know, this is the first substantial deal that he's cut since in the new Congress that's now divided between Democrats and Republican control. It also shows he is in fact capable of cutting a deal with Speaker Pelosi. I think the question now is, does it lead to other compromises on things like prescription drug bills or rewriting NAFTA, things that might potentially have, some bipartisan buy-in? Can this deal lead to other deals, or is this the deal that just allows everybody to retreat to their corners and fight it out towards the elections?
We will see with Susan Davis, NPR's congressional correspondent. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
Dance, little DJ, come on.
Gia DeSantis is a DJ at Nevada Public Radio in Reno. She joins us now. Hi, Gia. Welcome.
Hi, it's good to be here.
It's good to have you. And let's get to some of the music that you brought us. This is by Fences. This is called A Mission.
You are the river, but baby, you know I can't swim. You run through me coldly, through mountains, through trees and through hills. Guess that my drinking has become a form of a prison. And next to a veteran I lay on a cot in a mission.
Sad lyrics there, Gia.
He guts me every time. Christopher Mansfield is Fences, and his struggle with substance abuse is really worn on his sleeve. He is creating this beautiful music that you wouldn't necessarily associate with someone who had his start working with Ryan Lewis and Macklemore. He has co-written with them, and he was discovered by Tegan and Sarah's Sarah. She found a song of his on MySpace, and the rest is history.
And how did you come across Fences?
Well, people will talk to us about the music, right, all the time. And Fences is one of those that was kind of a sleeper. They sent it along, and Milena Joy, who is our program director here at NV89 with me, she and I started listening to it, and we went, wow, this is incredible. And we started to dig deep into what his story is. And he is one of the first signings for a label called Grandview, which is started by a guy named Pat Magnarella. He is Green Day's former manager.
and he really worked in that sort of harder rock world. So again, not everything that you would associate with someone who makes music like Fences does.
Okay, well, the next one that you brought us is by Jay Somm. This is called Superbike. Tell us more about Jay Somm.
Melina Duterte is Jay Somm's real name, and that song, Superbike, is from an album that is coming out on August 23rd, Kananak Ko, which means my child. And the name Jay Somm actually came to her via putting her own name into a baby name generator. So she's kind of like the indie rock darlings version of Childish Gambino when it comes to finding new names.
Childish Gambino, also not his real name. That's Donald Glover. Right, exactly. I wonder why people decide that for their art, they need to have a different name.
Apparently random name generators are quite a thing, especially when it's Wu-Tang's, which is how Childish Gambino came across his. Mm-hmm. But as far as Jay Somm goes, she's just this dreamy pop musician. She's opened for the National Tour of Japanese Breakfast. She's just as lovely as can be. And the music video for Superbike was shot in Joshua Tree. She has a pink cowboy hat that she's wearing in there. It really sort of lends itself perfectly to this deserty thing that I've got going on with our next artist.
Okay, which is Orville Peck. This is called Turn to Hate.
Tell me you can't stay.
Now, Orville Peck has been described as a masked gay crooner. Tell us more.
Well, as I am fond of saying, the long wait for a gay masked cowboy is over because we have Orville Peck. He croons about love and dusty landscapes, and he is a sub-pop artist who is suddenly getting a ton of attention. The amount of attention he got during Pride Month was spectacular, but nobody knows his name.
Are there a lot of gay country singers right now?
Not a lot. There are a handful, actually. Not in this sort of indie vein, but when you listen to Orville Peck's interviews and you read what he's saying, and he really doesn't vary from a script. He wants to keep his anonymity right there under the mask. There's a subversive culture that has always been there for a lot of country artists, and he's just taken it and he's run with it.
Okay, the next one we have is Mateel. This is called Keep the Change.
Just what did I get into? A hero walking on this floor. I thought it started as a daydream, but I'm not dreaming anymore.
A very confident voice there, almost swaggers, doesn't it?
I feel like we've gone from the dusty cowboy to a dusty Springfield with a touch of Nico and a whole bunch of sass and that lo-fi garage sound that comes with it. Her album, titled Satisfactory, came out in June, and she is really having her moment. She just came off of a fantastic performance at Glastonbury, and Keep the Change, the song that we just heard, it seems to me like a song that like Andy Warhol would have had on his personal Spotify list. She just has that sound like Nico and Dusty Springfield had.
How many concerts would you say you go to per year?
Oh, my goodness. that is tough. I have gone from going, to hundreds a year to, let's say, about 60.
Wow. Still, that's a lot. That's more than once a week.
It's more than once. It's the job.
It's the job.
It's
fun
the job.
Job. Okay, yeah. The last one we have time for is David Hopkins. This is called Selah. So we're hearing French there, but I can tell it is not a French person who is singing French. The accent is not of a French person.
It is not. He is an Irishman singing in French. He lives in Las Vegas. He has this album, Overlook, that he put out last year on Mark Stormer of The Killers label. And he has collaborated with Mark Stormer. He will not tour, so getting these songs out that he's worked on. By the way, just about everything on Overlook is about his 16-year-old poodle, which is, you know, a little surprising to me. He is, he says that he just isn't going to tour in support of it. It's opportunities like this that we're having right now and stations like we all listen to for NPR Music that are going to let people hear his music. And he was in this cult favorite band called Lear that is an Irish band, and they have a super devoted following still to this day, but he's not even going to work on anything with them anymore. He just wants to do his thing, playing his music and recording under deadlines for The Killers, Mark Stormer.
And singing about his poodle.
And singing about it. So who doesn't want somebody singing about their
poodle?
Well,
I mean, it's. I have a golden doodle who, you know, recognizes poodles and thinks I'm one of those. But then the poodle is never interested in dealing with the golden doodle. That's what I've found. Our listeners maybe have had different experiences. But
I have a Shih Tzu, so I have a Shih Tzu poodle mix, and I understand that feeling of, you know, I'm going to run with the big boys.
Exactly. Gia DeSantis, DJ at Nevada Public Radio in Reno. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
And if you want to hear more, it's on our Spotify playlist. That's NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
Two groups that advocate for crime victims, Human Rights Watch and Trial International, say that Gambia's ex-president, Yahya Jammeh, used his position and threats against families to pressure young women to visit him in his private residence where he would abuse them. And now a former Gambia beauty queen has publicly accused the former president of raping her. Tufa Jallo says she was 18 when this happened, and now the hashtag #IAmTufa has spread all over social media, kind of a Gambian Me Too moment. And Gambia's new president is convening a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to hear the women out. Tufa Jallo joins us now from Toronto, where she now lives. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You are the only woman of these three who have made these allegations to put your name forward. Why did you do that?
In Gambia, the culture of silence, especially around rape, and when I looked around me and in my country, I couldn't see a role model or a blueprint of anybody that has ever spoken about this openly. So I found motivation in the fact that someone has to say something.
Yeah. Well, and this may bring shame to your family, but you've said the silence is as uncomfortable and more damaging than the consequences of speaking. Was it hard to keep it to yourself?
Yes, it was hard because I felt like I was a fraud and I was trying to pretend like it has never happened. It brings so much shame, I know, but I just thought it was time for the country and the community to have to carry the shame and the burden that I had to carry by myself.
Well, if you don't mind, if we could go back over, you know, some of that day, because the allegation is pretty despicable. Again, you were a beauty queen, and you had in that way come into contact with the then president after you were in a beauty contest run by the Gambian Ministry of Education. And the president gave you gifts, installed running water at your family's home. But then he made advances and even struck you.
Yeah, he offered me a job first, which at the time I felt I was too young. And then he proposed marriage, which I thought was funny in the beginning. So I told him I wasn't ready to, because I was just 18 at the time. But yeah, he did struck me. He did change his tone on that day. He was speaking from a place of anger at the fact that a girl from a poor background, almost a middle-class family, will have the audacity to say no to his proposal. So everything that was demeaning enough in that moment to make sure I regret why I would ever say no was something he felt like he had to do.
You allege that he then injected you with a needle, raped you. Along the way, you lost consciousness and were kicked out of this building. And his aides told you what?
That he was the president and they will do anything to protect him. Mm. Yep.
He's no longer president. He's living in exile in Equatorial Guinea. Hasn't responded to these allegations, but his party says that they feel that these are Westerners, you know, with malicious allegations against their party and the ex-president of the Republic of Gambia. In other words, they're kind of aligning you and others who are making accusations with traitors.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. They will find any excuse, obviously, to defend Yahya Jammeh. And on top of that, I am a woman, you know, trying to take back power and speak my truth within a country that is very much steeped in patriarchy. So until then, I just seek for justice.
We should say that you're in Toronto now, but this is because you fled. I mean, you put on a niqab, a covering, crossed the Gambia River in a fisherman's boat, begged a truck driver to smuggle you across the Senegalese border, slept in a bus station there, then got asylum. You were an asylum seeker, seeking asylum from the president of your country. And others have said, with other women coming forward, that this was part of a state-sponsored system to get women to the then president, that you went to the president's office because, having won the contest, there was a drama proposal, a theater proposal. You'd suggested you thought you were going to be getting some sort of a scholarship for that. That never happened. Other women were kind of lured there by people who worked around him. Do you worry about the women and girls you've left behind?
Yes, I am. And that's one of the reasons why I came out, and also looking forward to go to this Truth and Reconciliation Council, because I myself am very curious in what the ministry and all these major institutions in the country, were they aware of what happens to these girls or the path to the scholarship that is being promised? So we're still trying to get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, Yahya Jammeh again, the former president. And now Gambia has set up a Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission to investigate these allegations. And according to Human Rights Watch, he is expected to testify later this year. Will you be there?
Definitely. And I hope me coming out before that and my story do encourage a lot of other women when the TRRC starts their session on sexual assault. So I do look forward to coming out there. Mm.
That's Tuva Jallo, a former Gambian beauty pageant winner, who's now one of several women accusing the country's ex-president, Yahya Jammeh, of rape when she was a teen. Tuva, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll follow this. And here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.